Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the podcast, our roundtable. But first, joining us today to update us on the transition as the Biden administration rounds its first 100 days in office are Michael Baer, the former chairman of the Defense Business Board and the president of the Dumbarton Strategies Consultancy, and Arnold Panaro, former staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who is now the chairman of the Panaro Group Consultancy and the chairman of the National Defense Industrial Association. Both of these gentlemen have been involved in the defense side of presidential transitions for many decades. Michael and Arnold, thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our cyber coverage and our weekly cyber report. FinCon Thierry Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our technology coverage. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our air and missile defense coverage as the company celebrates its 10th anniversary of the Iron Dome system. Michael and Arnold, always a pleasure having you guys back on. We are rounding the bend on the first 100 days of the administration, so we thought we'd jump the gun a little bit because we figure next week everybody will be discussing this. Michael, let me start with you. How are they doing? And more importantly, what have we learned in this first 100 days that tells us how this administration is going to behave in the remaining, 3 years and 265 days in office?
Well, thanks, Vago. I mean, looking back on these 100 days, I'm very struck by how different this administration is. I mean, if I would just take four specifics. One, it's been the most disciplined administration I've seen in eons. They're disciplined in many ways beyond just simply not leaking. Number two, they've applied a unique cabinet governance model, and they've applied it across the government from energy to defense to a host of other places. They've chosen very, very senior, multiple administration experienced executives in the National Security Council, people like Kurt Campbell or Liz Sherwood Randall, who stepped down into White House staff jobs and who then, for the cabinet departments, picked the people, set the policy and budget, and then handed over to the cabinet secretaries to execute. Third, they've staffed up the absolute reverse of every administration I've observed before them. They've started from the lower levels up rather than the traditional top down. In defense, they quickly delivered 90 plus junior politicals to run the department, well before those people's principles were even identified, let alone confirmed. And lastly, probably the most consequential, is while not all the combatant commanders have realized this, around the globe, the Department of State and its Secretary Tony Blinken are unambiguously in the lead. DoD for this administration is now firmly in the supporting enterprise role. So those are just four of many ways that I think this is a very different administration with a distinct and different construct and a very different operational template. Over.
Arnold, your sense?
I would just underscore, I agree with everything Michael said in terms of what's been accomplished. I think another fundamental shift to underscore is in the major national security overarching framework. We've gone from what was called America First, or primarily a go it alone in the world approach of the previous administration. I call it kind of a stiff arm to the rest of the world, to the Biden administration's approach of diplomacy first, whole of government, working with allies and partners, emphasizing the powerful State Department and National Security Council, as Michael has outlined, with DOD in the supporting role, not a lead role. And the key tenets and implication of this kind of diplomacy first are profound. And again, with Michael, they are incredibly disciplined in going about making the changes they said they were going to make and what they've done. From the laser focus on attacking the COVID pandemic and reviving the economy with the COVID bill and accelerating vaccines, this singular focus on climate change that has the Secretary of Defense and the head of our intelligence organizations calling it an existential threat, the focus on China, you know, they've restored the civil service workforce protections. Another fundamental change that I predict is going to occur, they're going to tackle sexual assault in the military with what is likely to be a fundamental shift away from the chain of command and handling it. And of course, they're emphasizing diversity. And as Michael said, we're seeing a predicted, expected, and I would argue needed shift in the influence and power in DOD with an increasing role for a very powerful deputy, Kath Hicks, Cape Comptroller, Dove's Old Shop, and a decreasing role in influence for the Joint Staff and Uniform Military in policy and budget matters and somewhat operational matters. And they're doing 18 major reviews, everything from the strategy to global force to China to extremes in the military. We probably won't see those changes till FY23 budget coming up in February 22, but any changes that are immediate, they could imply right away. So I think Michael is correct. We have a fundamentally different approach and a very disciplined approach as they approach the first 100 days. And I would say some would argue they don't get all the best style points, but if you look at the substantive accomplishments, they're quite significant and quite fundamental. Over.
You were decades with the SASC, preeminent authorizer. We have heard from the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Adam Smith, voicing his concerns that he has not yet seen a budget. And that seems an unusual admonishment for a senior lawmaker to make aimed at an administration led by two former senators, one of whom spent decades in the body, including 8 years as vice president. How is the relationship of this administration with Congress and key committee chairmen going? And what does that tell us going into the future, especially if control of Congress changes in 2022?
I believe there was a recognition that there needed to be significant improvements in the way the executive branch, and in particular the Department of Defense, work with Congress and going back to the traditional ways of coordination, advance notice, collaboration, working together respectively, particularly when you've got to get 61 Senate-confirmed people through the Department of Defense, for the Department of Defense, through the Senate Armed Services Committee. And frankly, I think, as I mentioned, people are faulting them on the style points because I think they've had some startup problems in terms of changing that dynamic, which needs to be changed. And certainly, if you don't get the budget, as our colleagues on this program well know, in the time frame that Chairman Smith has indicated, we're headed for both the authorization and appropriation bills being finalized, if at all, right before Christmas. And certainly you don't want to start with another continuing resolution. There was hopes we wouldn't do that. But I mean, they're going to have to do some really significant improvements, in my view, in their congressional relations approach if they're going to be able to get the kind of support they need. And they claim they're going to make a lot of tough changes. We'll see. Over.
Michael?
Bago, I would say there's probably two other relationship matters that evolved that are pretty significant here. There's a lot of focus on the ethnicity and sex of the presidential appointees at the Department of Defense. But what I find more interesting is the dramatic shift in age. We've made a complete step function in the kinds of people that are in those leadership positions that are inbound. And their backgrounds are so dramatically different than the highly militarized backgrounds that existed over the last four, and even before that, over the last 6 years, particularly in the secretarial staff and in the staff of the service departments as well. And in that regard, I think both Arnold and I expected to see a much stronger view. This is the one thing I was surprised about. I expected to see a much stronger view about civilian control in the department. And if you go back to the secretary's confirmation, what Secretary Austin's committed to was in fact civil-military cooperation, not civil-military control. And that were those words, civil-military cooperation, simply don't exist in the law. So there's, it's clearly those relationships, the relationships within the building between the Joint Staff and OSD, are very much a work in progress. But like Arnold said, I mean, I'm beginning to see what I think is a rebalance back to what I think was the intent of the framers. And that's a very good thing. Over.
Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Look forward to having you guys back on as there's more transition news. Hope you both have a great weekend and a great week. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Vago. It's been a pleasure.
Always a privilege, Vago.
And joining us now on our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington are Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many roles is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, welcome back.
Always a pleasure, Vago.
Thank you.
Great to be back.
Good to be back, Vago.
And I want to give three kudos across the piece. Mackenzie, terrific event with Adam Smith, and we're going to talk about it. Dove, you've been rocking it in terms of some of the pieces you've had out recently in The Hill. Kudos to you. And Byron, your notes still remain the best in the business. So congratulations to all of you. And Iron Mike, all I can say is thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Vago. I appreciate that.
Michael, let's start with you, right? I mean, we just heard from Arnold and from Michael about how the administration is doing, certainly game-changing elements to this administration, and do want to get your, everybody's sort of take on this in the context of the other things we're going to talk about. How's the administration doing in the first 100 days from the standpoint of other members, and where are we with the National Defense Authorization Act? And Chairman Smith's concerns in particular, right? Because all of this stuff is going on, you know, as the January 6th commission is moving, is moving ahead. And we've got infrastructure going on and now tax raises, climate. I mean, it's a very fulsome agenda. Just sort of give us an update on how lawmakers feel about this first 100 days of the Biden administration and where we are on the things that matter to us most, or at least matter most to this aerospace and defense audience.
Sure. So Arnold Pinero said something that I thought was pretty prescient. You know, he did say that he does think the administration needs to improve their congressional relations approach. And frankly, I couldn't agree more. First, when it comes to the budget, I mean, we talked last week, you mentioned today, Adam Smith, who's the Democratic chairman of Armed Services, is very frustrated about some of the lack of communication and also the timing of the budget. They were anticipating a budget to arrive on the Hill on May 3rd. It doesn't look like they're going to make that date. I've been told by multiple sources on the Hill that now they're expecting something by May 17th. But if they do not make the May 17th date, which apparently they're now expected not to make, that they will not be able to mark up their defense authorization and appropriations bills and get them off the floor before the August recess. So all of this now gets pushed into September and October. Now, look, we were going to have a CR anyway. It's just a question now of how long that CR is going to be for. And it looks like we're going to end up with a much longer term CR than we would have otherwise. The appropriators I've spoken to already are planning on kicking the can into September. I can't remember ever the House doing that. The Senate's done that before, but I can't remember ever a time where the House has done that. So there's incredible frustration. At the same time, I think that, the Biden does what a lot of other presidential candidates do and did. And I think Obama did the same thing. There's a lot of talk about bipartisanship and working together. But I just, you know me, I'm not a partisan. I just don't see it. And the people I talk to on the Hill, I just don't see it. I mean, this administration's definition of bipartisanship seems to be trying to appeal to people who vote for Republicans, but not to the Republican lawmakers. And they made that same mistake, by sending Kamala Harris to West Virginia to talk to voters to try and muscle Senator Manchin, and that didn't work. So, right. I correct me if I'm wrong, but I still don't think that Biden's invited Leader McConnell over to the White House to meet with him yet. So, there's a lot of disappointment on the Hill, even when it comes to the defense numbers, which we talked about previous week, when we're adding tremendous amounts of money to the deficit and the non-defense domestic discretionary has gone up dramatically. But the defense numbers don't seem to reflect the challenges that we face in the world. There's been failures that the way they've handled the border and confused messages on foreign policy, too. I think, the administration released this declassified the Khashoggi investigation. But to what end? And when I talked to friends at the State Department, they can't figure out, to what end. So what's really the end game there? So I think that there's room for a lot of improvement.
Mackenzie, I want to go to you because you had a terrific conversation with Adam Smith, one of a series that he's had. He had a great conversation with Roger Zakheim. I think it was last week. Talk to us a little bit about what struck you as most interesting in that discussion.
Well, we don't need Michael's inside sources because the chairman was very clear in saying actually May 10th is his deadline to not to get a bill done before August recess. And he said essentially that it's not happening. The White House won't return his call, quote unquote. And, you know, it's just not a priority. They're not interested. And I think that's really the key message that he's trying to convey is that this is not a priority for them, right? The COVID bill was the priority and other issues too. But I also think there's a lack of incentive to move the 22 numbers, right? In the COVID bill, if you look at, for example, the Department of Education, right? Most of that money is for fiscal year 2022. Non-defense discretionary saw dramatic growth in the COVID bill for 22. There's no reason that Democrats need to make any sort of deal to have regular order for 2022. If you CR'd the whole year, only defense gets screwed. So, you know, I'm worried about the longer term, and I think the chairman is too. But I would also say, you know, it was a really interesting, we had a great conversation. He was very candid. He basically said his framework for the bill this year, like sort of the chairman's mark, are three different reports, won't surprise anybody. The Future of Defense Task Force, cherry picking some of their best ideas. The AI report that Bob Work and Eric Schmidt co-chaired. And the third report, which is the supply chain work that's being done by Congressman Gallagher and Slotkin. So, you know, that gives everyone a sense of kind of the priorities. It gives members, you know, ideas for what they want to work on going forward. You know, he's continuing his war on the ambitious defense strategy. You know, that's fine. He talked slightly more positively about the F-35, sort of. But, you know, what's interesting is that I think other members of his party are taking his cue that it's okay to now, you know, to be openly, very publicly skeptical about that program. And I'm looking forward greatly to Byron's comments because I couldn't tune into that hearing. You know, and he's even a little skeptical of, you know, some of the Pacific Deterrence Funds and initiatives priorities, although generally supportive, I think, overall.
Dove, what's your sense, right? Not just on the first 100 days, but some of the messages and other things that we've been hearing, right? I mean, certainly unusual to have a House Armed Services Committee chairman not getting called back from a White House of his own party, right? And Jack Reed, and I know you're close to Senator Reed, right? I know Senator Reed is not all that happier.
Well, look, I mean, I think that the whole way they're looking at national security is so fundamentally different from what's come before. I would even include the Obama administration in that, in what I'm just said. Their view of national security is first and foremost climate change. It involves, and you saw the president was out front at the climate change discussion, and you had the Chinese president there too, which also tells you something, I think. There's that. They've made it very clear that they see national security in the broadest possible terms. Well, the broader you define it, the less important the Pentagon becomes by definition. And I think it was Arnold Pinheiro earlier in this program who rightly said, you know, the State Department's taking the lead, and that's not wrong. The problem is that defense is not really getting what it needs in order to implement the strategy the administration supposedly says it wants to pursue, which is a great power competition strategy. So that's one element. Then there's another element that a lot of folks don't notice, which is that human rights has become a huge driver. And that is affecting our relationships with a whole bunch of countries, particularly in the Middle East. But it also affects the way we look at Russia and China. And so if you start looking at everything from that perspective and add that to this broader national security perspective, then money for the military just isn't that important anymore. And for that reason, I think I don't think they're deliberately stonewalling the Hill. I just don't think they're paying attention, which is quite different.
I understand what you're saying. Or they're really trying to work to readjust stuff and having that debate and discussion, right? I mean, we were talking about the top line budget numbers that ended up being higher than we assumed that they would be. And that was in part because the White House apparently said, much to the consternation of progressives, and I think very much in line with what Chairman Smith has been saying, that at the end of the day, we have to invest in national security. And yes, we're adding burdens, whether in climate or anything else. And so, hey, let's try to alleviate a little bit with some more top line money. So I'm not sure that they don't care, but I think that they're so focused on what it is and all the reviews that Arnold mentioned and Michael discussed that it's changing. But I agree with you that it does constitute a strategic shift in looking at security in a much, much broader way than necessarily what military power is about, military power, bringing to bear military power. Byron, I want to bring you into the conversation because you've been paying, you've been writing about this stuff and are a student of history and, you know, listen to also the F-35 and strategic forces. So I want you to talk about those as well, because I think we might be at a watershed moment, as Mackenzie mentioned, in terms of the outlook for the F-35. I mean, that was a pretty damning hearing, but want to get your sort of macro sense and then discuss those two hearings and why you thought they were so important.
It was McCain-esque. It was just fascinating to see a blowtorch basically taken to this program. And that's not the way this has been treated in the past, at least in recent years. So I think, you know, there are a range of issues on sustainment costs, on readiness levels, on engine availability. And, you know, I think the clear message is, you know, as much as Congress may have plussed up the program in the last 3 or 4 years, that's probably certainly not going to happen this year. And I think, you know, kudos to Mackenzie for her AEI event with Chairman Smith. You know, I thought it was interesting as he also alluded to some of those issues as well. Maybe the news out of that was he had nice things to say about the B-21 bomber program, which I found really interesting.
Right.
On the two hearings on basically STRATCOM and SPACECOM, the STRATCOM issues were probably more interesting, particularly in the House hearing, because of Representative Turner's comments about another DOD study that apparently is looking at a fleet of 200 Minuteman missiles, with the other 200 or so being used to spare part and sustain the remaining smaller force. Now, that's a study, you know, but I think, it just kind of gets back to this this question of the land-based part of the deterrent of the triad. And I think there's another hearing this coming week that Senate Armed Services is going to be holding on kind of strategic deterrence in general. There was an interesting essay today or yesterday that came out on April 21st that Bill Perry wrote about the land-based component of the deterrent. So I just think we're going to continue to have these debates. I'm really not worried about ground-based strategic deterrent this year or next, at least the funding levels on it. But I think there's still a lot of open questions about, you know, how big a program it will ultimately be. How will it be paced? I really appreciate the comments that Admiral Richardson made about, look, you know, Minuteman, you know, you've got an analog system. I mean, it really has to be updated or changed.
Right.
But there's still going to be, a pretty sporty debate about this this year and next.
Mackenzie, I know you've got to jump off in a minute, and just wanted to ask whether you had any last thoughts before you've got to hop to your next meeting.
Yes. So that was a great summary by Byron. Right. I agree that this is a unique moment for those two programs in particular, by which I mean the Joint Strike Fighter and the Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent, which is already a program of record. I expect there will be big emotional and heated debates on both of them and potentially big changes in the 2023 defense budget. What's interesting is that, you know, the departmental pushback, and it spans a range of leadership on the ground-based leg of the deterrent, right? They are out front, they are leaning into this debate, heavily weighing in, saying basically there's no savings. It actually will cost more to service life extend the Minutemans than it is to just go forward with the ground-based strategic deterrent. And they're leaning into all of the other angles of the argument, like, you know, I can't access the sea leg, and, you know, one of the other leaders, you know, departmental leaders talked about, you know, why you need the ground-based leg, and we're going to have to go back to a different alert level if you know, changes are made fundamentally to the triad. Anyway, very interesting. And then on the back to the chairman, right, that was, there's almost never praise anymore for any Pentagon weapon system. And it was a good news story for the Raider. And it wasn't, it was for a variety of reasons of which the chairman and I just spoke about, but it was definitely General Welsh had a big role in that by locking that program down personally. And then secondly, was the chairman's concern about the F-35 engine in particular. You know, this was knowable that Congress should have supported competition for the engines. There wasn't money that year to do it. So, you know, we are where we are. But basically in 2030, this is a huge problem. Just, it's already a problem. I was speaking with a senior military leader recently this week who said recently in the Middle East, 12 F-35 engines had to come out and be and worked on. So, you know, it's interesting that it's not just the aircraft, but also the engine.
And I should point out, right, I mean, one of the most damning bits of testimony came from Diana Maurer, who is the director of military structure and operational or operations issues at the Government Accountability Office. Greg Ulmer, executive vice president of aeronautics for Lockheed Martin, was there, obviously, who led the F-35 program from the standpoint of the prime contractor. Matt Bromberg, president of Pratt & Whitney Military Engines, was there. Lieutenant General Eric Fick, the PEO program executive officer for F-35, as well as Brigadier General Dave Abba, who's the U.S. Air Force's F-35 integration chief, were also all there. Mackenzie, thanks so very much for joining us. Absolute pleasure having you on. Hope you and yours have a great weekend and looking forward to having you back on again next week.
Thanks. You too.
Michael, bring us up to speed on where we are on infrastructure earmarks and how the defense debate is unfolding on the Hill, because those who are just sort of crying for more spending, just like those crying for dramatically less spending, have pretty much all melted away. So just want to sort of get your sense on all of that and where we are on it. And Dove, want to get, you know, come to you about the fundamental nature of that debate as well next. Go ahead, Michael.
So the two sides, Republican and Democrat, remain pretty far apart when it comes to infrastructure. Biden and the Democrats on the first infrastructure package are still at $2.5 trillion, give or take. The Republicans released their counterproposal yesterday, which is about $568 billion, well under the Democrat number. But remember, there's still a debate as to what classifies as infrastructure. And as you know, under the Biden plan, there are a lot of things, but there are implications for defense because there's over $180 billion in R&D money, which would have implications for the defense industry. The Republican plan doesn't include any of that. It's just very typical infrastructure, roads, bridges, rail, public transit systems, airports, drinking water, things like that. And to make matters even more complicated, the Problem Solvers Caucus, which is a bipartisan caucus of Republicans and Democrats who work together to solve problems, they're going to release their own proposal today. So there'll be three proposals out there. Pelosi and the majority of Democrats really are pushing to go straight to the reconciliation process and bypass bipartisanship. They feel the Republicans are delaying, they're stalling. She wants to have a bill off the floor by the July 4th recess, and she's noting we have less than 25 legislative days between now and then. So it's going to be a push. Look, there's a lot of members of Congress saying things about this. I think the one most notable for us is the chairman of the defense subcommittee in the Senate, Senator Tester, came out recently, you know, saying that this is going to be very difficult because of the pay for stuff. I mean, you're going to have to raise taxes on someone or it's going to have to go to the debt. And he says, I don't think either of those is very appealing to either side. So that, you know, then this is the first package, which talks about raising the corporate rates. The second package, which, you know, Biden administration leaked some details on yesterday, which sent markets tumbling, has dramatic implications for taxes. I mean, on the personal income tax rate, on the on dividends and capital gains, and that one, you know, they're labeling the American Families Plan, and that's about $1.5 trillion. I personally think that the reason they bifurcated these two is because the second one really stands slim to no chance of really passing, and it's a way to placate the progressives. But who knows? You know, and then as far as earmarks go, you know, that was an eventful week there because, as we know, the House already voted to, although it was a close vote, House Republicans voted to allow other members to submit earmark requests. But again, just for state and local governments and for nonprofits. The Senate earlier this week, 15 Senate Republicans sent a letter pledging not to support earmarks, saying they're inherently wasteful and prone to abuse. And what's notable is six of those members, which is over a third, are members of Appropriations or the Armed Services Committee across the political spectrum, said they will not support it. But at the end of the day, they chose not to vote because it's really symbolic. It's not binding. Senator Shelby, who, as you know, is the ranking Republican on the Senate Appropriations Committee, came out and just said, look, it's going to be up to the individual members to decide if they want to participate. If you want to ask for an earmark, you can ask for an earmark. So that process is going, and we will see earmarks in the defense bill for the first time in a long time.
Dove, how do you think the defense debate is unfolding?
Well, it seems to me that, as I said, it on the one hand, you've got a White House that, simply, as you've heard, simply has higher priorities. That's number one. Number two is there's no way they're going to get to 3 to 5% real growth. The growth in the budget that has taken place, once you factor in spending on COVID, which nobody anticipated 2 years ago, spending on climate change, which is part of the overall administration's view of that issue, it's not clear to me that you're really talking about much of an increase. I think the issue really is, do you hold the line? Remember, and Mike Hurston knows this far better than I, in the House, the left-wing Democrats, really, their votes are crucial. The squad itself is enough to overturn a Democratic initiative if they really were bloody-minded enough to do so. None of those folks are particularly keen on defense spending. So while we're not talking about 10% cuts or 5% cuts or anything like that, we are talking about holding the line, just not to go below any kind of increase. And so that's really going to be the focus, just to hold the line. And what that does is force the department in a very different way to start considering alternatives, because on top of everything else, you do have this at least announced shift away from the Middle East. And the Middle East gets a vote in all of this. And with the tensions between Iran and the Israelis not getting any better, with incidents all the time. I think it was Dennis Ross who told Jim Baker years ago, you may want to leave the Middle East, but the Middle East may not want to leave you. And I don't think anything's changed in that regard.
I'm reminded by a mutual friend that's actually originally a Trotsky's, right? You may be tired of war, but war may not be tired of you. But Byron, how is the street? I mean, we did have a little bit of a drop on markets, but I've been fascinated at the nature of the debate, right? If you watch financial TV, where folks are like, well, look, if you can actually get to a better tax structure that's more uniform, even if it's higher taxes, right, done the right way, it may be a beneficial thing, right? Not the sort of thing you expect on financial TV, and certainly not representative of markets, right? I mean, that's a reflection of hosts, and most of the, CNBC and everything else are really entertainment first than actual meaningful information, unfortunately. But how do you see this unfolding on markets? Because markets will have a vote on this, right? I mean, if markets react and it plays into a notion of, obviously it's a Trump talking point, but a Biden depression or a market overheats, inflation goes up and the whole thing comes apart. It's why we ended up with the Budget Control Act, right? Republicans were threatening to burn the House down and markets got so panicked that we needed to do something because markets, right, began to think that we would default on the debt. How do we need to think about this in a conjoined way as somebody who spent a lifetime on the market?
I'll try. Look, I mean, the market's up today. So yeah, it took a hit yesterday on the stories that came out on the taxes on upper income individuals. But I think then, the market kind of quickly pivots and says, well, how likely is that? The whole infrastructure debate, some of these infrastructure stocks are up 20-30% this year. They've given a little bit of that back. It's going to be very interesting to see how this all comes together in May, June, and July. Can you move infrastructure through reconciliation? And I do think, there are really stark differences between what the Republicans proposed and what the American Jobs Plan was, when you look at things like, and there's also a treatment that I think you have to read these things carefully, because, for example, the Biden plan included $115 billion increase for roads, bridges, and highways. But they didn't explain what the base budget was. And then the Republican version came out with, I think it was 289 or 299 billion, but that was total. So that's base and that increase. So there's all these messaging and optics going on here too, that I think needs to be parsed out. I think, you know, and I'll say one other thing, because I really feel this debate gets confused a lot of times by the headlines that are thrown around, a trillion here, a trillion there. You know, yeah, this is different. These infrastructure investment plans are different because they're really going to be spent over 5 to 8 years. I think there is some concern. You know, Larry Summers in particular has voiced a concern about inflation surging because of all these changes. There are clearly some very short-term signs of inflation, but I think that's really more a reflection of just the disruptions that occurred to supply chains as a result of COVID-19, where a lot of things people slammed the brakes on and now we're trying to get back to normal on it. So a year, I'll say this, I think also this idea that, you know, the economy is overheating. Sure, this year you're going to see, you know, by the IMF's calculation, I think 6% or more GDP growth, but then it slows to 3.5% in 2022 by their calculations. And probably after that, we're back down to a 2% type growth rate. So I do think I don't know where we're going to go with this, you know, what finally gets done with the infrastructure investment plan. I think there's still a path where nothing gets done. Reconciliation, I think, as Michael could very well comment, it's still a pretty perilous path. And I am skeptical. I agree with Michael. I don't see the kumbaya, big bipartisanship moment where everybody kind of throws down their positions and comes together and agrees on a major infrastructure package. I mean, there are just too many very basic fundamental debates about red state, blue state, urban, rural. What's the role of the federal government? And of course, you know, the core elemental issue, how do you pay for all this stuff? So the market, I think, you know, maybe learning to thread a needle a little bit more rather than just kind of reacting spasmodically to every headline. And I think, you know, as we play through May, there'll be I hope and I think a more measured appreciation about what Washington is actually able to approve to achieve on this front. And as I said, this could all end in tears. I mean, nothing could happen. That might be satisfactory to some people, but personally, I think there's some elements when you look at workforce or, you know, stepping up basic research and development spending, those should be very positive investments in the country.
Michael, I'm going to come to you in a moment for the unfunded, the interesting opposition to the unfunded requirements lists. And Dov, want to get your take on Russia, Ukraine, as well as the Iran talks. But Byron, do you think the F-35 is in as deep kimchi as it's beginning to look?
I think that the market is starting to signal that. You know, Lockheed Martin's price has been down. It was down yesterday. It was down again today. They really didn't talk about the program that much during their conference call. I think, you know, like a lot of things in defense, I don't really know what the plan B is here right now. I think you're not talking about the program being canceled. There's no alternative to it right now. But, you know, I think what you're really looking at is, you know, is Congress going to fund 90 plus airplanes in FY 22, 23 and 24, or is it going to be more like 60 or 70? And then the other critical factor, you know, look, if these issues are getting aired in a hearing held by the House Armed Services Committee, you've got to also believe that these are issues are going to be coming up as other countries evaluate their own F-35 purchases, both current and potential. And so that's another factor that I think is going to weigh on the program. But, you know, we're still a year or two away from, I think, where you really start to have credible plans that might augment or replace the F-35. I think the one positive thing that I heard, again, I'll reiterate it from Chairman Smith's interview with McKenzie, was hey, the B-21 program suggests the Air Force really can get these things right, and they can work well with industry to get them right. So that's a positive story. And he basically said, look, the Air Force has learned a lot of these lessons from the F-35. So maybe the next program or programs that reflect that, there may be a better path here. But yeah, I think at the very least, there's a darker cloud over the F-35 today.
And I should also point out, right, that there is a lot of optimism, for example, that NGAD, the next generation air dominance aircraft, tempered and shaped by the lessons of F-35 and B-21, is going to be a watershed program in terms of capability. And that certainly was the messaging that we used to get from Dr. Will Roper, the Air Force Acquisition Executive. Michael, talk to us a little bit about unfunded requirements, right? A feature of Washington that prompts many lawmakers to ask, why didn't you fund them? And sometimes gamed by the military services, I dare say, right? I mean, that which they know Congress will pay for, they cut from their own budget in order to try to use it as a sweetener to try to get some more cash. Dove, we can go to you on this because you were not crazy about those either. You thought budget forum is probably a more honest way of doing it. Michael, and then Dove.
So, you know, as you know, the unfunded requirements list, which the services submit to Congress every year of programs they want to have but didn't have enough money for, is
allegedly
required.
Allegedly didn't have money for. Go on.
Is required by statute. And frankly, they're a very useful tool on the lobbying side on Capitol Hill, and they're a useful tool for members of Congress deciding what they want to support and not support when adding funding to defense bills. And when they're adding funding to something, they're usually taking it away from something else because the top line is the top line. But it shows at least when members of Congress are trying to back funding for a specific program that it's something that the military actually wants and will spend the money on. So they are a useful tool on Capitol Hill. And a lot of the a big group of watchdog organizations recently sent a letter to Secretary Austin asking him to really limit these dramatically. They recognize they're required by statute and they're lobbying Congress to get rid of the UFA list, but they want him to really cut it down dramatically on the list he sends to Congress. And when I read part of this, I actually laughed out loud because it says in the letter, you will no doubt encounter some resistance from Congress, but you can also count on the strong support from the undersigned organizations, you know, like Code Pink, right? So if I'm Secretary Austin, I know I'm really going to be really thrilled to have the support of Code Pink, but yeah, at the same time, have Congress really upset with me. So I really think this is a kind of a fool's errand.
Okay, got it. Dove, broader philosophical thoughts on the unfunded requirement list and how good it is or not.
It's not actually, I'll give you an on the ground answer. The on the ground answer is very simple. The military really wants another bite at the apple after PA&E or CAPE, as it's now called, and the comptroller have made their decisions. It's as simple as that. And so given that they can go to the Hill, of course, they game it to some extent. But to some extent, it's simply that, you know, they're at odds with the Office of the Secretary over program priorities. And this gives them a way to fight the battle another day. I'll give you a concrete example from years ago. If it wasn't for something like this, and it wasn't enshrined in law at that time, I believe, we would not have had an AV-8B, the VSTOL, which has led to what we now have, the Osprey and short takeoff aircraft, F-35s. In that case, then PA&E was 100% against the program, and Congress added it. And so you get examples of where the Office of the Secretary, for all kinds of reasons, opposes something the military wants. And you know what? Sometimes the military is actually right. We constantly assume that they're not. And of course, the authors of that letter assume they're always wrong, which is simply not the case.
But ideally, right, don't you want what's really important to be included in the budget ultimately and go up as part of a unitary document as opposed to trying to do it in such a piecemeal fashion?
Of course, ideally. But we're living in the real world, and we're living in the world of the Pentagon, and we're living in the world of bureaucratic preferences and all kinds of arcane kinds of activities that make no sense outside the five-sided building. That is the real world we're in. And you're not going to change it fundamentally. We've been working for years to change the acquisition culture, and we still have problems with that. I think that one has to look at the reality of how this process works. Remember, it's a process that's 40 plus years old. It's not exact. PPBE is not exactly a new process, and nobody's come up with a better way of doing things yet. So we have to remember that as well.
Let me ask, we're almost out of time, and I have to ask you, Dov, to talk about some pretty significant international news. Obviously, Vladimir Putin's extraordinary speech, right? Russia is a nation of moral authority. America is not. We will defend our interests no matter what. Massing of a considerable amount of troops on the Ukrainian border. And then, of course, sort of get your sense on the aftermath of the Iran talks and where we are. Sort of bring us up to speed on this whole international stuff that we didn't talk much about this week.
Yeah, Putin was defiant. He spoke to a joint session of their Congress. They basically borrowed the idea from us, and he said, "Don't cross red lines." He didn't say what the red lines were, but he said, don't cross them. Now, there are reports that they're starting to draw down on 150,000 troops they've got surrounding eastern Ukraine. On the other hand, there are also reports they've got mobile hospitals out there. Mobile hospitals means that they're ready to fight. So we're not really sure where Putin is on this, but Putin is beginning to see that it's not just the United States that's outraged at what he's doing. He's alienating an awful lot of countries, and he may simply be backtracking, even as he threatens people not to cross his red line. So we just have to see where they're going, because we are getting mixed signals out of them. When it comes to Iran, first of all, you've got to remember that the Iranians really went into shell shock, when the day after they announced they're up to 60% enrichment, there's this huge explosion that sets them back. Nobody really knows how far it's going to set them back. And that obviously affects the way they approach these talks. Now, the Biden people are beginning to look very, very eager to get an agreement, because they've now signaled that they're prepared to consider getting rid of sanctions on oil and on some aspects of bank finance that clearly would make life a lot easier for Iran. So the question then becomes, does the Biden administration fall into the trap the Obama administration did, which is, you know, they get so eager to get a deal that they make the deal. And then, of course, the second part, which the Biden people said they want, which is a discussion of what Iran is doing all around the region and limiting that. And the Iranians have said, we're not going to talk about it. If they sign this deal and then discover that the Iranians walk away with it, I don't know how they're going to look.
Before we forget, 30 seconds, Dov, give us your take on the House legislation on Saudi Arabia, right, coming right on the heels of the administration's approval of F-35 as well as Predators to United Arab Emirates.
Well, it just shows you that the concern about human rights isn't limited to the administration. I mean, this vote was overwhelming, 350-71. I mean, that's true bipartisanship. And if I was sitting in Riyadh right now, I would be worried. By the way, it isn't the only legislation. And that one is called, by the way, Protection of Saudi Dissidents Act. And what it does is it suspends arms sales for 120 days to Saudi Arabia, to the kingdom. And there, it also provides for, if there's any intelligence that Saudis are bothering American citizens or international citizens, it provides for closing down Saudi diplomatic offices in the United States. And this is a huge blow. Nobody knows if the Senate's going to take it up or not, but they might, because, again, human rights is a big democratic priority. There are other pieces of legislation that are kicking around as well, including Tom Malinowski's legislation to prevent the Crown Prince from coming to the United States. And that one passed the committee, the Foreign Affairs Committee. So you've got this kind of almost explosion of anti-Saudi sentiment that really could complicate our relations with the kingdom.
Very briefly, though, right, what are the implications of this? Byron, I'll come to you in just a second. What are the implications, though, at a time when China is really trying to supplant the United States in that region, right? We have a vote. Riyadh has a vote. The Saudis have a vote.
Well, you know, China just signed this 25-year, $400 billion deal with Iran. They are talking to the Saudis and to others. The Russians, of course, are deeply entrenched in Syria. We move out, others move in. It's as simple as that.
Byron?
Well, I would just add to this, because I think it's fascinating what Doug pointed out about this particular piece of legislation. But you also had the Parliament in the UK condemn China for its treatment of the Uyghurs. And then I think the other fascinating thing was President Biden finally coming out and saying, hey, there had been genocide against the Armenians. And you can imagine how well that's going to go down in Turkey.
Although that's something that will go down very well, I think, in the Armenian community that's been waiting since 1915 for recognition of a historical fact. But
I think, it's always been kind of a hot button with the Turks. So it's just right. Really interesting. I think it was Michael earlier who talked about how human rights are really kind of bubbling up in U.S. foreign policy. And it really will have some repercussions, I think, that'll blow back into defense in ways that are going to be interesting to see how they play through.
I just want to piggyback on something that Dove just mentioned, talking about all the anti-Saudi legislation that's being proposed and passed on Capitol Hill. Is, you know, reflect back on what I said earlier, that the administration seems to not have any direction when it comes to Saudi Arabia, that they declassified this investigation into the killing of Khashoggi, and then to what end, right? I mean, they didn't change their policy. I talked to folks at the State Department. They don't really have a clear policy on Saudi Arabia. So now the Hill is taking it, and it's very dangerous. I mean, we have 5 Air Force bases in Saudi Arabia. The relationship is important. And somehow, some way, the administration has to take the lead on foreign policy here and figure out how we're going to get the good.
Guys, thank you so much for joining us this week. It's an absolute pleasure having you on each week. Hope you have a great weekend, great week, and look forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks a lot.
Thanks as always, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.